So if you combine Jonathan's priority monism with panpsychism, you get cosmopsychism. So I'm not necessarily totally tied to that position, but it is the one I've been more consistently attracted to because of Jonathan in the first instance.
Jonathan, why are you not a panpsychist, I guess? You see Philip here has grabbed your priority monism and ran with it. Yeah, why don't you go the full way and follow him?
Hey,
welcome back to another episode of Parker's Pensies. I'm your host, Parker Setacase, and this is a podcast where we explore all the deepest ideas in philosophy, theology, nature, and life. I love thinking about cool stuff, so come think with me. Today's episode is awesome. It's so cool. I'm so jazzed for it. I have with me two returning guests and philosophical legends today. I have with me Dr. Jonathan Schaffer and Dr. Philip Goff. Both have been on to talk about their particular theories of mind, or even if they're not their particular theories of mind that they've put forward. Dr. Goff has been on to talk about panpsychism, cosmopsychism, universal consciousness, top-down psychism, ground-up psychism, panpsychism. Panpsychism is just the view that everything has mentality or consciousness. It's awesome. So he's coming on to talk with Dr. Jonathan Schaffer. He came on to talk about a paper he wrote on ground functionalism. Functionalism is a theory of mind that says what it means to be conscious is to be a realized set of inputs, outputs, and internal states. I don't know if that sounds complicated. It shouldn't sound too complicated. But Dr. Schaffer's got a really fascinating view. He's a metaphysician, a really, really good metaphysician. And so he goes in for grounding principles. And there's this metaphysical mind-making principle that when an input and an output and an internal state happen, this is a metaphysical law that a mind will dance out. He's got some really nice language, actually. So I had them both on to talk about the mind. What is it? What does it mean to be conscious? What does it mean to be a mind? What does it mean to be in pain? And we compare and contrast different theories of the philosophy of mind. It's really, really fun, really high level, fun stuff. It's a huge privilege to have to even just talk with these guys. The fact that they would email me back is pretty cool. But the fact that they would come onto the podcast and talk with me, trying to help me understand their views, it's unreal. So this podcast is nothing but just a joy for me to do. With that said, I do have to keep the lights on. I do have to feed my dogs, and I do have to justify this to my friends and family and my wife. So if you guys like the podcast, please consider supporting me on Patreon or on YouTube members. There are perks at both of them. They're really similar perks. So this is your top five and you want to see me stick around, please consider becoming a Patreon patron. If you like these conversations, if you learn something, that would be huge. So you can find the links in the description wherever you're getting this podcast episode at. I could commodify myself a little bit more, but I won't. I should just say, hey, we have a Facebook group called Parker's Pensies Pensiers. I'll pronounce the second French word, but not the first one correctly. Pensiers. Find that on Facebook and I will let you in. You can talk with people like these two in the Facebook group. It's really cool. I'm trying to build a little community there of Pensiers, of thinkers, of Parker's thought thinkers. Pensies, Pensiers. So do find us on Facebook. I wonder if I have that link in the description. I should. If not, good luck, but go find it. All right. Without further ado, let's jump in with Dr. Philip Goff and Dr. Jonathan Schaffer. All right. Well, I have with me Dr. Philip Goff and Dr. Jonathan Schaffer, two legends. This is really, really exciting. Both of them have been on the podcast before. So go watch those links in the description. Dr. Schaffer, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. Dr. Philip Goff, thanks so much for coming back, both of you guys.
Thanks so much, Parker. I had a great time with you last time. I'm really happy to be back and here with Philip as well. So awesome.
Absolutely. It's a great podcast, Parker. You're doing some really good stuff. So I'm happy to be invited on again.
And
it's lovely to see Jonathan again. I haven't seen you. We're old friends. I haven't seen you for a long, long time. I like the beard.
Thank you. Thank you. You're looking good. I like the glasses.
Oh, yeah. I was just explaining before we went broadcast that I've just been at this AI thing in Sweden and I left my glasses on the plane, and so the only spare pair I could find has this sellotape in the middle, but so yeah. Looks it's good. Not a fashion statement.
Well, hopefully by the end of this conversation we'll be able to know whether that tape is conscious or not, and if it's grounded in fundamental reality or what. So we'll see. Yeah, I don't want to get too cheeky with the jokes here because there's a lot of them that we can make. But so the reason that
you're allowed one, you're allowed one. Right, you've had your one panpsychism joke.
That's good. I appreciate that. So the reason I wanted to have this podcast with you two is because I see a lot of similarities and I see some differences that I just want to get both of your guys' ideas on it. We've talked about it individually and now we're all here together, but I want to talk mostly about like mind and fundamentality. How fundamental is the mind? And then, you know, what is the mind? And can you have consciousness without mind? So these kind of like really fun questions, I think, are really exciting. And you two have both done really good work on it. So as we get going here, for maybe some of those who haven't heard the episodes before this, maybe we could start with Dr. Schaffer. Can you, I don't know, this is really hard to do, but can you give us maybe like a snapshot view of ground functionalism, what the mind is on that theory?
Yeah, sure, Parker. So the idea behind ground functionalism.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Is that the mind is a kind of derivative outcome of having a system that's organized by the right functional principles that mediates the right transitions from cause to effect, which a physical system could do. So the idea here is that we think of the mental state not as defined in terms of a causal profile, as on old sort of Lewis-style analytic functionalism. And we think of the mental state not as merely nomologically correlated with a functional or physical state, as on a kind of Dave Chalmers-style naturalistic dualism. But we think there's a kind of an intermediate grade connection that's neither an analytic connection true in virtue of meaning, nor a nomological connection that holds through these contingent laws of nature, but a metaphysical grade connection that holds in virtue of these constitutive principles of metaphysical making, mind-making principles in this case. So that's the core idea of ground functionalism, is that when a system inhabits the right functional roles, that makes it have the right mental states.
Yeah, that's super helpful. That was great. I think I was able to understand this by thinking of modalities, where there's like logical modalities, which I would see as like maybe the semantic folks, the analytic functionalists. And then there's like physical modalities, which I would see as like the Chalmers style. And there's metaphysical modalities. And maybe you don't even think there are those, but that's how I've been like getting my grip on it. What do you see the connection there?
Absolutely. And I 100% agree. So I do think there are these sort of three spheres in logical space, or logical or conceptual, or maybe analytic necessity, nomological and metaphysical. Although I'll just, at the risk of undoing maybe a useful way of getting a grip on these notions, if you ask me to try to understand nomological necessity, I'll say it's necessity holding fixed the laws of nature. And if you ask me to understand metaphysical necessity, I'll say something parallel. It's necessity holding fixed the principles of grounding. So the way that I'm trying to understand nomological and metaphysical necessity just brings us back to the notions of laws of nature and grounding principles. So I don't think of it as giving great independent purchase on the notion, but you know, it's a useful sort of interconnection between the notions. So in that sense, it can be a helpful way to sort of glom onto the idea.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, and that's what I'm trying to glom on. That's a great description for what I do in the podcast. That's so good. Dr. Goff, can you help us out with I don't know. Maybe you. I was thinking cosmopsychism, but I never know where you're at nowadays with the panpsychism. Which one you're toying with? So yeah.
Well, I'm open to a variety of options. You know, I think it's too early to sort of say this is definitely the correct view. Yeah. But I think I've consistently actually been more sympathetic to cosmopsychist versions of panpsychism. And I think this all begins with Jonathan, actually. I don't know whether he knows this. So I first met Jonathan when I was a postdoc at the Australian National University. People don't know what postdocs are. It's after you've finished your PhD, maybe before you get an assistant professor position. If you're lucky, you can get a post where you have a couple of years to sort of write some stuff without having to teach. And Jonathan had just started as a professor at Australian National University. And he taught me about this monism stuff in a bar somewhere. Mm-hmm. The Wigan Pen, maybe? Was it the Wigan Pen? I don't know. I can't remember. Right. That's where we used to go a lot. I can't remember quite. Yeah. And I was actually at this stage going through my panpsychism skeptical phase. I have this paper that was eventually published in 2009 called Why Panpsychism Doesn't Help Explain Consciousness. 10 years later, I've just published another paper called How Panpsychism Helps Explain Consciousness. Anyway, but so I've sort of spent my whole career trying to solve my own problems. But yeah, I had these worries about whether there's an explanatory gap with panpsychism just as bad as with physicalism. That, you know, there's explanatory gap with physicalism, how you get from physical facts to consciousness facts. But with panpsychism, is this explanatory gap how you get from particle consciousness to brain consciousness? And at this point, I worried it was just as serious. But when Jonathan introduced me to this priority monist view, which is kind of like, he can say better than me, but the universe is the one fundamental thing, and everything that exists is derivative from facts about the universe. And it struck me this was perhaps a way to, perhaps we could get onto at some point, but a way to solve some of these explanatory gap worries with a more micro-based panpsychism, you know, where it's everything's reducible to particles. So I've always thought, since speaking to Jonathan in that bar 15 years ago or something, that universe first forms of panpsychism do a lot better than particle-based forms of panpsychism. In fact, my academic book, my first book, Consciousness and Fundamental Reality, ended up defending a sort of universe first form of cosmopsychism. form of panpsychism. So if you can combine Jonathan's priority monism with panpsychism, you get cosmopsychism. So I'm not necessarily totally tied to that position, but it is the one I've been more consistently attracted to because of Jonathan in the first instance.
Yeah.
That's so, awesome. There you go.
Yeah. Well, so that's what's so fascinating here. Dr. Schaefer, or I'm going to call you both by your first names. I'm sorry for everyone listening. I keep mixing
How
up everything.
How dare you?
Yeah, I know, right? I'm putting myself, I don't
you
need a PhD
call me
now.
Dr. Goff.
That's right. Yeah. Jonathan, why are you not a panpsychist, I guess? You see, Philip here has grabbed your priority monism and ran with it. Yeah, why don't you go the full way and follow him?
Oh, not for any dispute over the monism side of things. There, I think we're in, as far as I know, we're in agreement about the whole cosmos being more fundamental than any of its proper parts. But rather, to the extent that we have a disagreement, and actually this would be interesting, for me certainly, to explore this, it's over the fate of physicalism itself and whether there is a very bad explanatory gap problem that physicalism falls into. So it's, I think, Philip, you'll tell us if this is misunderstanding your position, but that's sort of the main thing that you would find objectionable with physicalism. And I've tried to argue, oh no, you know, grounding can help the physicalist out of this problem. So that's one sort of issue, is whether physicalism is sort of haunted by explanatory gap worries, or whether there's ways out for the physicalist. But I'd also thought, and actually Philip's 2009 paper did a great job of convincing me that panpsychism wasn't going to help. So I wasn't thinking. So I was thinking, you know, to the extent that sort of the big game here is to, you know, resolve these explanatory gap worries, I wasn't thinking of panpsychism as offering much solace. But you know,
you were in the audience, Jonathan, when I first gave that talk, actually, and you were very helpful. And yeah, that eventually became that 2009 paper. But yeah, sorry.
Well, it's a great paper. I'm convinced by it. So I'd love to hear your further thoughts, where you've clearly come to think otherwise about the prospects for the panpsychist to resolve the explanatory. Yeah.
Real quick, some of the audience may not be familiar with the language, so I just want to address that really quick. Jonathan, can you lay out priority monism and priority microphysicalism for us?
Sure. Yeah. So priority monism is the idea that let's just focus our attention on the concrete material cosmos. Maybe there's other stuff out there, but that's not under discussion right now. Within the concrete material cosmos, the priority monist view is that the whole vast cosmos, that one single vast entity, is the most fundamental entity of the lot within among the concrete material objects. So the priority monist will typically think that there are some smaller things, like you and I, maybe ultimately particles or something like that, but that you and I and particles are derivative fragments of a more fundamental integrated whole. Yeah. Whereas the priority, did you say was microphysicalist? Was that the other one you were asking?
Yeah, that's usually what I see as the opposite. And then there's maybe priority substance or substance priority or something. But
where the priority monist starts with the biggest whole as most fundamental, and sees this process of carving things down as a way of deriving more things from its fundamental whole, the priority, in this case, the microphysicalist, will start with the smallest microphysical bits, maybe particles, and we'll say that those little bits are fundamental, and she'll kind of have a kind of inverted order from the monist. And she'll say, instead of carving things down, rather we build things up. She can allow that there are bigger things like you and I and planets and galaxies and ultimately the whole cosmos, but she'll say that they derive from their smaller proper parts.
Yeah. Okay. And then Philip, this is like, I think this tees you up really well to describe different views of panpsychism. Can you lay out like the priority monist panpsychism versus the microphysicalist panpsychism?
So, yeah, thanks. It's just what you'd expect, I guess. So panpsychists think consciousness or some kind of conscious entities exist at the fundamental level of reality. So if you have the sort of micro level fundamentality view, where maybe particles like electrons and quarks are the fundamental things, then combine that with panpsychism, you're going to get the idea that electrons and quarks have very, very simple forms of consciousness. And then somehow, God knows how, somehow they combine together to make the consciousness of human or animal brains. Whereas if you prefer priority monism, so the cosmos as a whole is the fundamental thing, then as a panpsychist, you're going to think the cosmos as a whole is some kind of fundamental conscious mind. But as we discussed briefly before we started broadcasting, that doesn't necessarily mean you're a pantheist, doesn't necessarily mean you think the universe is God, because it doesn't necessarily mean you think the universe is some kind of intelligent agent. You might think it's only after millions of years of natural selection that you get intelligence and agency. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in my 2017 book, Consciousness and Fundamental Reality, I defended a cosmopsychist view where the consciousness of the universe is just some sort of meaningless mess. It's very complicated because the universe is a very complicated place, but it's just a kind of meaningless mess. I mean, you might, if you had some other motivations, I've explored if you're motivated by kind of fine-tuning to think there's some kind of cosmic goal-directedness, then maybe you might take cosmopsychism more in a sort of theistic direction. But if you're just trying to explain vanilla consciousness, then you're probably not. You're just going to end up with this meaningless mess kind of cosmic universe. But then the idea would be that human and animal minds and everything else that exists somehow derives its existence from this fundamental cosmic conscious mind.
Yeah, that's helpful. I'm glad that you used the American vanilla for us as well.
Yeah, that was another discussion we had before. Not bog standard, which I discovered in another podcast is not really an American friendly term.
Right.
So maybe that's the British way of saying vanilla.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I was Eric Schwitzgebel. We had Eric Schwitzgebel on my podcast.
Oh, nice.
And I was talking about bog standard physicalism, and he was the what? He was completely confused.
Well, so something that I continually wrestle with, and sometimes I have a grasp on it, and other times I lose it. And right now I feel like I'm losing the grasp. How is like a cosmopsychist view, how is that not a physicalist view? Because in your Consciousness and Fundamental Reality, you talk about the deep nature of matter. And, you know, it's from like Russell and Russellian monism, and how it's like you make this distinction. Physics tells us about, you know, what physical particles do, but not what they are. And I wonder if panpsychism is physicalism or how it's different, or maybe it's, is it property dualism? I'm never quite sure on this. I just don't know.
Well, it's a difficult question how you define physicalism. I mean, I'm curious as to what Jonathan would say about that. But one, this is the issue, the argument I always have with Galen Strawson, who was my old PhD supervisor. He uses the word physicalism or materialism in an incredibly broad way, such that panpsychism or cosmopsychism do end up being forms of physicalism, because he thinks the physical is just like this stuff. Point at it, right? You just sort of point at it. So the stuff around us ends up being having a consciousness involving nature, then that's just what the physical is. So that's physicalism. And as you say, we Bertrand Russell-inspired panpsychists think that the consciousness stuff is sort of the deep nature of the physical. My response to Galen, and this came up again in this, there was a volume of essays responding to my work called Is Consciousness Everywhere, published last year. And me and Galen had this perennial argument again. You know, my response is just, you know, this is a pragmatic issue, how we define words. And I just don't think it's a very helpful way of defining it so that everyone turns out to be a physicalist. It's better to define it so that you can have the debates. So, I mean, I guess the main definition I would use for physicalism would be the idea that physical science, physics, with its purely quantitative vocabulary, can in principle exhaustively describe the fundamental nature of reality. It gets a little bit tricky because certain physicalists like David Lewis think there are these quiddities that we can't quite get at with the language of physics. Jonathan's actually responded to that, saying sort of deflating this worry a little bit. But so there are other ways you can kind of modify the definition, but I think that's a good first pass definition. That, you know, physics is giving us, on its way to giving us, the complete fundamental nature of reality. I think that's in the public mind, what they think, you know, they would think physics is on its way to doing. And so on that view, that panpsychism is certainly not a form of physicalism, because we don't think physics is ever going to be able to give us the complete story of what's going on at the fundamental level, because it's missing out all the consciousness stuff.
Yeah. So we need psychology too, you're saying. Yeah, that's maybe.
Yeah, metaphysical commitments. We need philosophy.
There we go.
But well, I mean, all of these are philosophical options. Yeah. But yeah, you're right in the sense that the panpsychists think there are some mental properties, if you like, psychological properties, mm-hmm. that are not, they're not non-physical in a sense, as you say, they're the deep nature of the physical. So the Bertrand Russell idea is physics just gives us this mathematical structure, and for the panpsychist, that's, that mathematical structure is filled out with consciousness. Mm-hmm. It's consciousness that breathes fire into the equations, to use Hawking's memorable phase.
Love that.
Phase, yeah. Phrase, not phase. But yeah, they are metaphysical commitments that don't just drop out of physics, that you couldn't read out of a physics textbook.
Yeah.
Even if it was the final theory.
Okay. That's really helpful. Jonathan, you got thoughts on that? I'd love to hear what you have to say about physicalism and whether or not you think panpsychism's physicalism or anything that's popped in your head so far. Great.
No, that was really interesting to hear. I didn't realize what Galen Strawson's view there was. So I guess it's very hard to define these notions. I think of this as kind of a two-step process. First, let's try to define like what's physical or what's material. And then let's see if we can use that to define sort of physicalism. So trying to define what's physical / material is very difficult because we don't want to tie, and there's a sort of classic dilemma in the literature, like we don't want to tie it too much to the contents of current physics because it'll almost certainly false, it'll almost certainly be superseded. But we don't want to be just sort of anything goes open to wherever future physics might go, because future physics might find itself invoking consciousness. You know, that is right. An open sort of empirical possibility for physics.
And Carl Hempel intensifies, yeah. Hempel's dilemma.
Thank you, yes, Hempel's dilemma, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Probably the best that we could say now, I think, is we could point to some contemporary programs in physics that posit sort of mindless matter, like just mindless particles swirling in the void or something like that, mm-hmm. and say, this is a paradigmatic example of a physical / material, merely material reality. And you know, then we just have to look, you know, let future physics come our way. Let's try to evaluate whether it's sustained that kind of image of like mindless matter or whether it's gotten something maybe a little trickier might happen. And then just who knows what we're going to say. So I think there's this notion of what's physical or what's material. And then physicalism, as I understand it, is the view that only that sort of stuff is fundamental. And if there's any distinct mental stuff, it's not fundamental. So that's compatible with saying there is fundamental mental stuff, but it's identified with the physical stuff, like on the identity theory, or it's compatible with saying there is no mental stuff on an eliminativist view. That's a really wild sort of view. But sort of, I think the most natural development of that is to say that there's mental stuff, but it's derivative from the physical. It's not fundamental itself. So that's the kind of core idea for me of physicalism, is the idea that there, you know, the sort of best version of it by Myatt is like, of course there are mental states in the world, but they're not fundamental. They're derived from a more basic, mindless, fundamental physical layer.
Okay. Yeah, that's really helpful. I wonder if maybe we could flesh some more out between you, some distinctions between you two. If we talked about what a pain is, so like what would a pain be on ground functionalism versus a pain on cosmopsychism? And like maybe how do I come to experience pain in the different theories? Who's up first?
Go, yeah. You go first, Jonathan.
I'm not going to have much more to say. I'm not sure the views are going to differ actually in what they'll say about.
Okay.
But I'll be interested to hear what Philip will say. But by my lights, what a pain is it's an experiential state. You know what it is. It's that ouchy sort of thing. So I'm not thinking of it as anything to be defined in functional terms, that's something that an analytic functionalist would want to do. So if I'm highlights, like, you know, if you want to know what the term pain means, I'll tell you. Pain means pain. That's as far as much more general view of the meanings of terms. They almost none of them have interesting analyses. So pain's, you know, pain's just pain. and then where I take the views to differ is in their explanations as to why there's pain in the world, or why there are mental states in general. Because I mean, I guess a panpsychist needn't think that she can have some derivative mental states. She'll just, she needn't think pain's among the fundamental mental states. But just suppose, to fix the idea for now, that that she'll say, yeah, and pain's on the fundamental side of the mental states. Yeah. Then the dispute, as I see it arising, isn't sort of what pain means or what it is, but rather why it's there. And for this kind of panpsychist who takes pain to be fundamental, she's going to say, that's as deep as it gets. There's no deeper story. That's how the world starts. That's right. Whereas for the physicalist will say, no, there's something underneath. There's something deeper, these sort of mindless states of matter that somehow enable us to explain the presence of pain in the world. And this is why the sort of explanatory gap arguments that we were hinting at earlier are playing such a prominent role in the debate.
Yeah. Well, so I wonder about like multiple realizability in other animals. Like from what I heard, there's like the classical story of here's what substance dualists believe and here's what functionalists believe and identity theorists. And a lot of people will say, hey, if you say that pain is an ouch, then you're a dualist about pain. You that's what the dualists say. And so it's so intriguing that you would say that. My dog feels pain, I assume, or maybe I infer. My dog feels pain, but we have different minds. I think we have different. We obviously have different underlying structures, right? Hopefully, I don't have a dog brain. But how do you cash out the similarities that we're both experiencing pain, or do I experience like human pain and the dog experiences dog pain?
Well, that's where functionalism sort of enters the literature as an attempt. It's contested whether it succeeds, but it's an attempt to say what different species, whether they be dogs or an octopus, or maybe even like a sentient Martian science fictional creature who's wired completely differently than we are, what they might have in common such that they can all, you know, experience pain or be in the same mental state. And there the idea is they don't have the same physical substrate, but they might realize the same sort of abstract causal profile. So so you and your dog and, you know, all of us and the octopus as well might all, crudely speaking, be making transitions from bodily damage to the tissues, to some kind of avoidance behavior. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that we're all mediating those transitions, and there's a state for each of us, might be a different state for each of us, but a state for each of us that's mediating the transition, that mediating state is the realizer of pain, even though we can each have different states realizing our pains.
Okay, yeah, that's helpful. All right, Philip, I'll turn it over to you here.
Yeah, so as Jonathan says, I don't think we're going to disagree on the nature of the mental state itself. I mean, there are radical forms of physicalism, which I do have a disagreement on this issue with my friend and podcast co-host, Keith Frankish, who's an illusionist.
Right.
So he thinks, you know, the phenomenal, what we tend to call phenomenal consciousness, the subjective quality of pain, he thinks that's a kind of illusion. And in terms of the pain he does believe in, he would just give some kind of a functionalist definition of that in terms of behavior, basically, not just external behavior, you know, so avoidance behavior when the body is damaged, but also behavioral connections between parts inside the organism and the brain. But so he would just define pain in those behavioral terms. But I don't think Jonathan's that kind of illusionist physicalist who, well, he's just made that pretty clear, that pain is pain. It's the feeling of pain. It's that, you know, ow! So, yeah, so the well, maybe I could say, start to bring out the disagreement maybe by saying why I'm not totally at this stage willing to embrace Jonathan's view. I mean, so I think Jonathan's got a really interesting view. Actually, he's got a quite novel and he's sort of created his own position to an extent, which I think lots of other people have run with. And actually, just to give Jonathan one more compliment, everything is so specialized these days. I find so often metaphysicians just don't do any kind of philosophy of mind and vice versa. You know, I think if you go back 30, 40 years, people like David Armstrong and David Lewis, these big figures, did the metaphysics, but, you know, had views on these, the knowledge argument against materialism and on the ontology of consciousness as well. But I think Jonathan's one of the few kind of metaphysicians who's taken these explanatory gap consciousness issues very seriously. Mm-hmm. So anyway, compliments over. Let's where I think I disagree. I guess with Jonathan's form of physicalism, it's not so much that I don't think it could be true. It sort of seems to me very different from what I've always understood physicalism to be. In fact, it seems much closer to David Chalmers style dualism to my mind than to physicalism. So maybe I could just try and spend a couple of minutes making that clear. So, you know, I've always thought of physicalism as the view that consciousness and everything else is nothing over and above physical goings on. In something like the way a party is nothing over and above people dancing and drinking and having a good time. And, you know, it's not like there's people dancing and drinking and they bring into existence this thing, the party that sort of floats above their heads. You know, all we mean when we say there is a party is there's people dancing and drinking and so on. I mean, I've raised this with Jonathan for whether we need special grounding laws to bring into existence a party once you've got people dancing and drinking. And well, maybe we could get onto that, but it doesn't seem to me we do, because all it is for there to be a party is for there to be people dancing and drinking, that the reality of the party wholly consists in the people dancing and drinking. Analogously, my conception of physicalism, even if they don't strictly speaking have an identity, nonetheless the view should be that my pain wholly consists in certain kinds of physical functioning in the brain. It's nothing over and above the physical workings of the brain. Whereas on Jonathan's view, and maybe he can correct me, but the idea is, in some sense, so he uses the word grounding for the pain grounds, sorry, the brain state grounds the pain, but the pain is something, as I've understood his view, something genuinely new, something ontologically extra, something over and above all the physical happenings. Indeed, we need these special grounding laws to bridge the gap. Because it really is this ontologically novel thing. And then it really does just sound like David Chalmers' view. So David Chalmers thinks, you know, pain and consciousness and physical goings on in the brain are different kinds of property, and we need these special, he calls them psychophysical laws, to bridge the gap between the brain goings on and the consciousness goings on. So they seem to me very similar views. Okay, now there are differences on Jonathan's view. He wants to say it's metaphysically necessary. It's grounding rather than causation. I guess it's causation in charm. But then I start to lose my grip on what the difference between grounding and causation is. If what is produced is something ontologically extra to the producer, then why isn't it just causation? And even if you say it's metaphysically necessary, I guess I'm suspicious of those kind of non-transparent necessities. But okay, well, I would just think that's a necessitarian version of David Chalmers' view. So anyway, that was a bit long-winded, but I guess that's my thought, that it doesn't seem like what I always understood physicalism to be.
Yeah, Jonathan, hammer back now. Now we're not friends anymore. Now we can actually go for the jugular.
All right.
Yeah.
Actually, I think Philip and I don't disagree that much about pain. What we really disagree about is about parties. As I'm understanding Philip, you're saying that for there to be a party, all it takes is for there to be people drinking and dancing and cavorting in the right ways. And I'm thinking, no, actually, something more is required. I'll say what that is in a moment. And so I do think the party, in some sense, hovers above and is something genuinely new in addition to all the people cavorting. And here's why. A party is a unified individual event. All the various cavortings and drinkings and dancing and whatever are lots of little, smaller events. Just as we saw in the monism and microphysicalism case, we have a kind of a mereological hierarchy of bigger and smaller. And we typically, in that case, posit a special connecting operation, mereological fusion, if you're going from the small up to the big, or fission, if you're going from the big down to the small. It's exactly the same scenario here with events. If you want to get from lots of little events, you know, Philip dancing this way and me drinking that way and Parker chatting over there and all of us, you know, doing our little bits to contribute to the making.
Sounds like a good party.
Hey, let's have it. I'm thinking the party is something where you have to believe that smaller events compose larger ones. In order to believe that there is a party, there is room for the very depressing view that I'll call party eliminativism, where the party eliminativist, let's say, she'll grant that Philip's dancing and Jonathan's drinking and Parker's chatting, but she'll say, but all there is just a bunch of people, as it were, arranged party-wise. There's no bigger thing, a party that they compose. It's a further substantive claim that, by my lights, has to be backed by a kind of this, something like a mereological fusion principle on events, a kind of generative principle that's making genuinely new big things out of a bunch of small things to say that there's a party. So I agree with Philip's characterization of my view as being a surprising form of physicalism that doesn't go in for a kind of very reductive, the pain is, you know, just is like the little physical stuff doing its thing, but embraces this more sort of inflated conception, non-reduced conception. Pain is just this, you know, kind of experience. But what I want to say is the mistake that was made was in thinking that the rest of reality outside the mental could be so simply and easily reduced without using kind of grounding principles. So I think it's in a very general way, every physicalist should allow that to the extent that there are parties at all, it's because there are these metaphysical principles, in this case, mereological fusion, that makes them, or it's like there are persons at all. It's to the extent that there are metaphysical principles, be it fusion or fission principles, that make them, whether it's from the whole cosmos or from the smallest parts. So I'm thinking that the physicalist needs to review her background to metaphysics first. And move past this picture that Philip was articulating, which I think is the standard picture in the literature. So on which sort of all the rest of the stuff, the non-mental stuff, just sort of is nothing over and above and comes for free when you have the physical stuff. And the mental is something special because you need extra principles. And it needs to see that you always needed the extra principles in all the cases. And then follow-up claim, we can get the mental in just the same way.
Good. So I'm glad we can trace the disagreement there. So I guess it's a disagreement about the metaphysics of grounding rather than in particular, its application to the mind-body case. So, yeah, as I say, I mean, it's not like I've got any big particular objection to your view. You know, I think it could be true because it doesn't feel like the kinds of physicalism I really worry about. But yeah, it does seem to me there's too much metaphysics going on in this party case. It just seems to me, I don't know. It seems to me like all we mean when we say there is a party. So I agree with what you said to the extent that shows there isn't an identity, right? I don't think there's an identity here. It's not that the party is identical to Jonathan drinking and Parker chatting, and because of course Parker might leave the party and Susan Schneider might come in, but it's still the same party. But I suppose if I can put it in truth-making terms, this is something associated with a lot of people, including my colleague here at Durham part of the time, John Hyle. You know, I think sentences about parties are made true by sentences, by facts about people dancing and drinking. So the talk of the party is made true by the people dancing and drinking. And the disagreement, well, I don't know, again, to too much technicality, the disagreement I have with John Hyle is, I mean, I think to make sense of that, we have to hold that existence talk, when we talk of a party existing, is maybe a bit sort of a looser sense of existence than we mean when we say, like, a particle exists or God exists or doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. So I think because we've used language in this broader way, like we say, oh, there's a party at Jonathan's tonight, you got to come, just to mean. So we say there is a party just to mean people are getting together. So then this sort of creates a new sort of lightweight sense of existence. So the party exists, it literally exists, but all it is for it to exist is for people to be gathered in these ways. Well, yeah, so that would be my view, that the truth-making view, that sentences about the party are just made true by the people dancing and drinking and so on.
So is the concern, Philip, that on Jonathan's view, ontological pluralism like looms or something, and we'd have to like be committed to like an actual party, the ontology of parties as well?
It just all seems to me so very unnecessary, all this. And you know, I think if we started coming on the metaphysics of parties to, for what it's worth, your person on the Clapham omnibus, they said, what are you talking about? All I mean when I say there's a party is there are people dancing and drinking. I think we just use language in such a way that those sentences are made true by people dancing and drinking. So the way we use language ensures that, and so this heavy-duty metaphysics seems to me just a kind of unnecessary. I'm happy to postulate, you know, when it's really necessary, but I just think this simpler story about how we're using party language avoids the need for all this heavy-duty metaphysics.
Mm. Well, so one thing that, Jonathan, if you want to jump back on that, that's cool. One thing I wanted to broach in bringing up what is a pain and trying to flesh out differences, maybe I should have asked what is a mind, because the way I see it, Philip, as a panpsychist, is going to have to either use vision to individuate a mind from the cosmos, if you're a cosmopsychist, or fusion to combine the fundamental BBs into a mind that experiences pain. And so I think there's like the individuation or combination problems. And then for Dr. Schaffer or Jonathan, it looks like a pain. Well, I'm still kind of confused about the metaphysical picture of functionalism, but it seems like a mind is not like a substance, like a substance dualist would say, but like a combination or a pattern of events in a brain or emergent from a brain. I know emergent's a wild word to use, but so that's kind of what I was picturing of you two and how you might say what a mind is and the thing that experiences a pain. I don't know. Maybe I'm totally off there. Jonathan, you got anything?
I would say that I'm happy to, normally in these debates, I focus on the property side of things, the mental properties and the physical properties. But I also actually, I'm happy to recognize minds as sort of on the object side of things. And I just, in the same way that I would recognize molecules and chemicals and organisms as individual entities going up the kind of levels hierarchy of nature from sort of chemistry to biology. So I'm happy to recognize minds as sort of another sort of entity that are realized by but not identical with anything that we found at the lower levels. So I'm happy to say that there are minds. I'm happy to say why we find them in the, or try to, put forward a theory that attempts to say why we find them in the world. But then if you're asking me, what are they? I'm going to say the same kind of trivial, disquotational kind of answer. Mind means mind. And just like in the pain case, fortunately, we do know what both of those, we do know what those mean. So when I tell you that a given word means pain, that helps you understand the word because you know what pain means, and likewise for mind.
So I appreciate that.
I'll ever give for almost all meaning.
Yeah, that's good. Well, and you've made the point in the previous episode that, you know, conceptual analysis is kind of bunk. It's kind of failed. We have tons and tons of counterexamples. So that whole notion of philosophy has produced lots of counterexamples, which is fun. And humor says a similar thing. And I was recognizing a similarity between you two. And then you told me earlier that you guys are actually students together at Rutgers. So that makes some sense.
And this is really a kind of a Jerry Fodor view. So let's give a shout out to the great Jerry Fodor, who I think recognized early on that the project of conceptual analysis of notions like knowledge and causation, which I banged my head against that for the first, sort of few years of my career, didn't solve the problem. And not just me, like people like David Lewis, like some of the greatest philosophers have, tried to give conceptual analyses of these notions, and it never worked. So there's a really strong inductive argument to be given that conceptual analyses always fail. Fodor tied it into a certain view about concepts, where he had this idea that concepts are themselves these just kind of atomic entities, and they have kind of reference conditions to the outer world, but they don't have like the kind of internal structure to support conceptual analysis. Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, so I wonder then if we're going to go with the disquotational view, where a mind is a mind. What do we do about things like machine consciousness and the AI kind of stuff? And Philip just got back from a conference, so I'm looking to hear from him as well on AI. But what would we do? I can recognize him. I can recognize you have a mind, I think, maybe inference to the best explanation plus a little analogy or something. But when it comes to new things like machines, machine consciousness, how would we go about recognizing that, a mind is a mind in a machine? And maybe now we slipped into epistemology, I guess, but just any thoughts on that?
I mean, I want to hear Phil's thought about this more than I have, but I'll give a quick sort of functionalist answer, which is that what we might find from looking at the places where we do have a good grasp of where there are minds and where there at least seem not to be minds, of course, the panpsychist will contest that, but like just taking that as a given for the moment, we might be able to come up with some pretty decent local generalizations across these cases. For instance, it might be that it requires the right kind of functional organization in the local cases that we're starting with to make a mind. That's a kind of functionalist view that I like. And then what you do is you go to the hard cases like the machines, to the extent that we can, try to export the best generalizations we can find from the cases that we have a better grip on. And if it's a functional principle that we're exporting, then it's just going to be a question of whether the machines are ultimately implementing the right functions. And they can do that, at least in principle. So
that's Philip, please.
Yeah, well, I guess this kind of links back to Jonathan wondering why I'm not so concerned about the explanatory gap worries for panpsychism. And there's a couple of different reasons for that. But one reason is I'm less and less, I'm more and more inclined to some kind of strong emergentist view of biological consciousness. So according to which there are kind of extra principles bridging the gap between consciousness at the level of particles and consciousness at the level of the human brain or the animal brain. So biological consciousness is some ontological novelty. And one reason I'm inclined to think that I push a little bit in my new book, Why the Purpose of the Universe, coming out in November.
Nice.
You can actually coming out in February in the US.
All right.
Illinois does like a huge gap between the UK publication and the US publication. But anyway.
If it's Cambridge, they've got to ship them over, I think. I've heard that about Cambridge.
It's Oxford University Press, but that's what they said. Yeah, they said they've got to have 4 months shipping them over.
Yeah.
Anyway. So one reason for that is thinking about the evolution of consciousness. This is going to come back to AI.
Right, sounds good.
I think it's a very serious question. Why aren't we zombies? Why didn't we evolve as zombies? And my answer to that is that natural selection just cares about behavior, right? It doesn't care about the quality of your inner life. Mm-hmm. It just cares about behavior that's going to be good for survival. So, I mean, there's a lot of different pieces in this argument, but basically the claim is that to make sense of consciousness having evolved, it must make a behavioral difference. It must be that systems with consciousness behave differently and survive better than systems without consciousness. And therefore, the emergence of consciousness must have made this behavioral difference, must bring into being new causal principles over and above the basic equations of physics. Okay, Jonathan's a smart philosopher and can see there's a few missing steps in this argument, but that's what I ultimately think, that that there must be some strong emergentist picture where, if just going off the basic equations of physics, you're not going to be able to predict what a conscious system does, because consciousness at the biological level brings into being new causal principles. Okay, because only in that way the argument goes, can we make sense of why it was a survival advantage? Otherwise, it would be overwhelmingly likely that natural selection would have made us as zombies. Okay, so how does this connect to AI? Well, I think, so with things, these incredibly impressive large language models like ChatGPT, they're so complicated, we've to an extent lost track of how they're doing what they're doing. I was chatting over dinner to someone working at OpenAI who was part of the team working on ChatGPT-4. We've lost touch with it, but, and this was confirmed in this conversation, I think we still know that in principle, if not in practice, everything they're doing is reducible to the basic equations of physics. So if I'm right that biological consciousness is strongly emergent, or macro level consciousness is strongly emergent, we can infer that large language models are not conscious. And, you know, and furthermore, that just more and more complex information processing isn't going to get you consciousness.
Yeah. Well, okay. So here's a question I'm having here. If you go in for strong emergentism, then why do you need panpsychism in the first place?
Good question. And this might be an interesting point of connection with Jonathan, actually, because so my claim is, well, I think where panpsychism earns its value is in this Bertrand Russell inspired way of reducing physical reality to underlying facts about consciousness. Mm-hmm. So because physics is just kind of mathematical structure, then as far as physics is concerned, fundamental reality could turn out to be anything. As long as it has the right mathematical structure, you're going to be able to get physics out of that. So the panpsychist manages to reduce physical reality to underlying facts about consciousness. Okay, then you still have to have, I claim, this strongly emergent biological consciousness. Nonetheless, what I want to say is we still end up with a very, if we go panpsychist rather than David Chalmers style dualist, and as I've said, I find Jonathan Schaffer's view, Jonathan's view, seems to me kind of similar to that in substance. If you go for that rather than panpsychism, then I would say you end up with two kinds of property, right? The quantitative objective properties we get from physical science and these qualitative subjective consciousness properties. Whereas if you go panpsychist, there's just one kind of property at all levels. So it's a more possible. Now, why I think just finally, sorry, I'm talking a long time, but just finally, as we're talking, it occurred to me why this might be interesting to connect to Jonathan. Is I think, so Jonathan is well known for defending, I think what's become known as Schaffer's razor, as opposed to Schaffer's laser, as opposed to Occam's razor, that we should base our ontological commitments just at what we find at the fundamental level. Now, in some sense, I'm sympathetic to that, except only when we're thinking of grounding the way Jonathan characterizes it, where there's these fundamental bridging principles, and to my mind, it's more like Chalmers dualism. Well, then I would want to count the grounded properties as well, because they're these genuinely new things. So I think they would count for or against parsimony as well. Mm. It's only, to my mind, that things only don't count parsimony-wise when they're sort of nothing over and above. Because parties are nothing over and above people and dancing and drinking. So we don't want to count the parties as well as the people dancing and drinking. But where you've got these bridging laws, whether you call them grounding laws or not, that bring into being these new consciousness properties, then I want to count those in terms of the parsimony of your view. Yeah. So if you go panpsychist, it's important then to go panpsychist, because you've only got, in terms of the properties that count for or against parsimony, you've just got one kind of property.
Well, don't you still have fission and fusion? Depending on the view, if you're a cosmopsychist, you'd have like a fission law, right? Where it's like when Parker comes into being, like my consciousness is different than yours, which is different than the cosmopsychist universe. Wouldn't there still be like similar types of laws that you want to count for Jonathan?
So I think my view would be quite similar, that you'd have these new laws that bring into being these new properties. I mean, I might not put it in terms of laws. I prefer the idea that the particles have basic combinatorial capacities, but I don't think that really matters for this discussion.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's a similar view. It's just, the bridging principles, bringing into being these new forms of consciousness. But But still, at the base and at the high level, you've just got one kind of property. Okay. And I think that's a saving. You know, so yeah, the most parsimony, the ideal would be a really reductionist form of panpsychism, such as Luke Roloff's, one of my favorite philosophers. He just got a job at Texas. Tries to have a very reductionist panpsychism. That would be great. But I'm more and more skeptical we can do that. So, okay, you have to have a bit of strong emergence, but still, it's still a real parsimony saving, in my view, if at all levels of reality, we've just got one kind of property.
Yeah. Jonathan, a lot there to tackle. What do you think?
Sorry, I talked too long there.
I don't know. I'm sort of tempted to talk about parsimony, because I actually think sort of at the root of a lot of these issues are some sort of underlying methodological disagreements about how to think about parsimony. It's sort of hard to get fascinated by parsimony when you're just starting out, but then when you see the work that it's sort of systematically doing in different debates, it comes to be sort of, I think, a fascinating core topic. So so I've defended what Philip nicely called Schaffer's laser, which is the idea that we measure the parsimony of a theory not by the number of entities that it posits, but by the number of fundamental entities that it posits. One of the motivations for doing this was sort of thinking of things on analogy with how we measure the conceptual economy of a theory. So we don't want theories to just use too many primitive notions. That's sort of a bad making feature of a theory if it just willy-nilly multiplies primitive notions. We love theories that get by with a slender handful of primitive notions, but it's no knock on a theory if it can use its slender handful of primitive notions to define some new concepts. In fact, it's a virtue, it's a strength of a theory that you can use its primitives to define up a whole host of other interesting concepts. So the sort of part of the motivation for upgrading to the laser from the razor was this idea that, well, if you think about how things work on the conceptual side, we don't count all the concepts that an approach posits against the theory. We only count the primitive concepts against the theory. We actually credit the theory with definable concepts. That's what I call that sort of the bang for the buck methodology. We want the sort of the strongest from the least. Likewise, I think when on the entity side, we want the same kind of approach. We want to get the most bang for the buck. We want to be able to start from the smallest handful of fundamental entities. And if from those fundamental entities, we can derive more further entities, that's not a knock against the theory any more than defining a new concept was a knock against theory. That's a credit to the theory. And just like with these defined concepts, they are genuinely new concepts, even if they have a definition. So, for instance, we've been talking about sort of mereological fusion. So my brain's already loaded to talk about mereology. I'll stick there for the moment. So one of the beautiful things about mereology is we can actually start with, we can do classical mereology with a single primitive notion. We have some choices. We can take parthood or proper parthood or overlap. These are all interdefinable notions. Part of the beauty of the theory is you can start with a single primitive notion and define this wide range of other notions in its terms. So let's say that we decide to start with parthood. Doesn't matter. Okay. We find out we can define overlap. This is a victory for the theory. Not a cost of the theory that we've got a new concept, a victory that we've defined it. It's a genuinely new concept. It's a new concept. So that's what I think the grounded outputs are like the defined concepts. They're genuinely new. It's an achievement to get to them. They're not a cost of the theory, but an achievement of the theory.
So what do you make of... like where does the mind making law come from? I guess because we're using the concepts, right, and derivative concepts and stuff. So if it's not a cost, in order for it to not be a cost, like Philip's trying to push, it would have to come out or fall out naturally of whatever is most fundamental or something more fundamental. right? Does that make sense, or am I not getting what's going on here?
Yeah, good. So, no, you are, but let's make a distinction. But when we were talking about the minds or the mental properties, that's one sort of entity whose fundamentality is to be considered. But then there are those laws, those bridging principles. That's another sort of entity. And we might ask, oh, what are the ontological costs involved with positing these kind of, whether you want to call them laws of metaphysics or grounding principles? I don't mind. The sort of laws of metaphysics is a bit of a joke on against the posit. Grounding principles will do perfectly well. There's a question of what ontological costs sit on posit and grounding principles. And there, I think, this is a further substantive matter. Some people have wanted to say, oh, maybe you could sort of reduce or derive all of the grounding principles. I think that can't be done, because I think to derive anything, you need to have some principles in place to do the derivation. So it's my view that there have to be, if you like any of this sort of ground theoretic framework, which you don't have to, but if you like any of that ground theoretic framework, I think you're committed to there being some fundamental laws of metaphysics, some fundamental grounding principles. But, sorry, just to finish up on mind-making, that leaves open whether mind-making is one of the fundamental ones or not. If it is, then it is some cost of the theory of my kind of ground functionalist approach that it adds a new fundamental root metaphysical principle. Mm-hmm. So it may be that the theory has to go that way. My hope is, though this is not, this is just a hope. My hope is that this can be unified under a broader, the mind-making principle can be subsumed under a broader class of functional generative principles that we needed anyway.
Yeah,
that's a big claim. But if that could be substantiated, then I would be able to sort of make the sort of the big happy for the ground functionalist happy conclusion that, like, we got the mind for free in the sense that we did need a mind-making principle, but it was derivative from principles we needed anyway. So it might cost a new fundamental grounding principle, but it might not even cost that.
Yeah. So we got here like towards the end of our first conversation, and I thought this is fun because this might be a way to further the theist, non-theist, theist, naturalist, physicalist debate, because if there are more fundamental mind-making principles, or not just more, but fundamental mind-making principles, that might look like mind was one of the goals in the beginning. It looks like mind's more special, but if it just falls out of deeper laws and you get it for free, it's like, no, it just mind's just kind of, they happened to be the case. And that's great for us who are phenomenally conscious minds. That's cool. But it fits more neatly with a physicalist story maybe. Yeah. Philip, thoughts on this?
That's really, really helpful. And I'm not unsympathetic to a lot of what Jonathan said, but so suppose we have these, the physicalist, so let's just drop the worries about whether Jonathan's view is proper physicalism or not. Let's just talk about Jonathan's physicalism and my panpsychism, which is going to have these generative principles as well. I would think of them in a different way, but I guess I would think of them as more causation rather than grounding. But okay, let's not worry about that. In fact, let's just talk in Jonathan's terms about... So you've got the grounding panpsychist and the grounding physicalist. They've both got their generative principles, but on the for the grounding physicalist, it still seems to me you've got two very different kinds of property. At the base level, you've got these purely quantitative properties, whereas popping up in the mind, you've got these qualitative subjective properties, whereas for the grounding panpsychist, they've got the same generative principles, let's say, so they're equally matched in that regard, but still there's just one kind of property in the mind and at the base of reality. Isn't that a more simple and unified view and and so a more attractive view, Jonathan. What are you?
Oh, that's interesting, Philip. Let me just make sure that I've got the picture right. I was thinking, so you're on your kind of panpsychist view, only the sort of subjective phenomenal properties are fundamental, and the other sorts of properties, these sort of quantitative properties, those are derivative. Right? Is that right?
Yeah. So they're just. They're just kind of a matter of how. So physics is just a kind of matter of how consciousness stuff behaves.
Right. Yeah, but there are these. You're not denying that there are the quantitative properties posited by physics. You're not denying physics. You're just saying it's grounded in the experiential. If I'm understanding that right, it seems to me that we both accept that there are the quantitative and the phenomenal properties. Your view is that the phenomenal properties are fundamental and the sort of desubjectivized quantitative properties are derived from them. And the physicalist inverts that order, says the quantitative physical properties, I think they have quiddities too, but let me put that.
Oh, nice. All right.
Let me put that to the side. The physical properties come first and the subjective properties come out later. So to the extent that there is a difference in kind between the quantitative and the sort of subjective experiential properties, I think we both have both of them and we just disagree about which one comes first.
I suppose I want to say they're nothing over and above, but I don't know how comfortable you are. The quantitative properties of physics, I certainly don't want to say we need some bridging laws to get them out. Really, all there is in the ontology is consciousness stuff behaving in a certain way. That is all there is. Maybe I'll say it's an identity, right? It's an identity.
Multiply realizable. It's multiply realizable. So I thought you wouldn't.
You mean the
an identity? The quantitative properties are going to be multiply realizable from subjective bases. So by your lights, there oughtn't to be an identity.
Is that? Let me make sure that I'm following. I'm thinking like there are still third person physical facts that all three of us could look at a cup, and like recognize that there's a cup there, and that looks like that's more the quantitative being explained by physics, because I am individuated from the cosmos, so I have my own consciousness that's separate from yours, and so I have phenomenal facts about me, but we can still recognize third person, you know, objects and facts. Jonathan, is that totally different than what you just said?
Where the third person objects and facts, Parker, are sort of, we're talking, when I was saying that there's sort of quantitative properties or things that aren't sort of aren't subjective. Yeah, then I think we're saying the same thing. Cool.
And then ultimately they're reducible to physics, but then the panpsychist claim would be the facts of physics are nothing over and above underlying facts about consciousness. So I suppose that's why I want to say the on the panpsychist view, the quantitative facts of physics don't count in terms of parsimony because they're nothing over and above the underlying consciousness facts. Whereas I guess I want to say on the grounding physicalist view, they both should count because what's bridging the gap between them is these grounding principles. So yeah, we are. I guess we're back to our fundamental metaphysical assumptions here. Yeah. So I guess I would say, you know, where you're bringing into being something via these grounding principles, well then the thing produced is gonna count over and above the producer. And so insofar as I'm thinking of Jonathan's grounding physicalism, I'm going to want to count the consciousness that is produced as well as what produces it. Whereas I don't want to count the on my panpsychist view, because the physical properties are nothing over and above underlying facts about consciousness, I don't want to count them. I don't think they ought to be counted. So that's why I think it ends up being a simpler view. But it's interesting we've come back to those. I guess this nothing over and aboveness plays a big role in my metaphysical thinking. Whereas I don't think you have any place for that apart from identity, Jonathan?
I don't love the term. I mean, I'd be interested to hear more to understand how you're thinking about it. I've come to think that there's identity, which is, we both agree, isn't at issue here. And then there's grounding. And then, like, I don't know what nothing over and above means beyond one of those two options. But, you know, I'm open to learning more. And maybe there's some room to pull apart different grounding scenarios where some of them have some nothing over and above action and some of them lack anything over and above the grounds. I mean,
maybe I could just say a little bit more again. I guess I'm thinking of it in terms of truth making. So, you know, suppose we start off with a world where there are no tables, but there are particles arranged table wise. But we naturally start using table language. You know, we say, oh, there's a table over there. Go and have your dinner whenever we're around particles arranged table wise. And as we start using that language and it becomes part of acceptable official language, maybe it was just slang at first, but once it becomes official language, then I would say it is literally true. It is in the fullest, strictest sense true that there is a table when there are particles arranged table-wise.
You started by saying that there are no tables. Did it change? Did tables pop into the world? Or are you saying that there are tables is true even though there aren't tables? I think there had to have been tables from the start through maybe a mereological fusion operation on the parts, so that our talk of tables could have something to refer to in order to be true. And if we're in a nihilist scenario where there are no tables but just particles arranged table-wise, then talk of an individual table, there's no individual corresponding to it for that talk to be true.
So this is where, I mean, and this is, as a, going back, connected to the dispute I have a lot ongoing with John Heil. I think to make sense of this, I think you're pressing a very good worry, Jonathan. To make sense, it sounded like I was contradicting myself, that I started off saying, let's start with the idea that there are no tables, and then I end up saying there are tables. To make sense of this, I think we have to have a distinction between us, a kind of heavyweight and a lightweight notion of existence. So the heavyweight notion of existence is what we employ when we say God exists or doesn't exist, or numbers exist or don't exist, or, you know, particles exist or don't exist. But then I think, so there's this strict metaphysical notion of existence, but I think inevitably we use language and existence talk in a much more loose way. So even if we accepted that in this strict metaphysical sense there are only particles, we'd still naturally start saying, oh, there's a table over there, go and get it, you know. I think that sort of creates another sense of existence, because if we're true, if it now becomes literally true in the language that sentences about there is a table is true when and only when there are particles arranged table wise, then that expands the English meaning of existence and it becomes literally true, but it exists in this more lightweight sense that just comes from this more flexible use of language.
Would that mean that tables, the concept or the abstract object, was like created and it's like an impure abstracta or something? Like there's a historical moment in which the impure abstracta of tables like came into existence and existed in the same way as a triangle or something?
That is the kind of worry you might have. So I don't want to say that, but I can see how what I've said might be interpreted in that way. I don't want to say, you know, our use of language creates the table. I want to say that once language has been expanded in this way, it is the sentence, there is a table here, is true. But that sentence, with the meaning it has, you know, we didn't make it true. It's true because of its truth conditions are satisfied. What it requires of reality to be true is part of reality. So I want to try and resist that.
Yeah. So we got a little we got into the ontology of tables and chairs and the reference of the words. I wonder real quick as we close out here. So we got priority monism. There's also a view that I hold more, which maybe I want to get you guys to just poke some holes in, maybe disabuse me on our way out. Ross Inman, who has appropriated a lot of your work, Dr. Shep or Jonathan, he goes in for like a substance priority. And I'm wondering if you, instead of looking at the grand picture, the macro picture or the micro picture, the fundamental BBs, what if we just went in for like substances and said, well, substances are the things that exist, the fundamental BBs, or things, I don't know, caught up in a life or however Peter Van Wagen catches it up. But like the substance is the thing that is the mind. You know, it sounds like substance dualism probably because it probably does lead to that. But I wonder if going in for substance priority, is that less parsimonious than priority monism? Or do we just say like substance and, you know, cosmos, are they on equal playing fields, or do you have to count up all the substances and that's a cost of the account?
Oh, this gets into some very tricky parsimony issues about quantitative versus qualitative parsimony.
Yeah.
So leave sort of Ross Inman's substances off to one side just for the moment. Yeah. And let's compare the sort of the cosmos first priority monist to the microphysicalist who has particles first.
Yeah.
Now, the priority monist side has just one fundamental entity and one type of fundamental entity. But the priority microphysicalist has, I mean, 10 to the 80th, who knows,
right,
how many token fundamental things. Mm-hmm. And there's also a question of, she might have one type of fundamental thing, particle, but she might have many if she thinks that there's, you know, different types of particle.
Right.
So it's hard. When we get to specific parsimony comparisons and we have to factor in types and tokens and quantitative and qualitative parsimony, it gets very tricky. And I think the Ross Inman view is kind of on the same side as the priority microphysicalist view.
Okay.
In terms of like, maybe there's one type of fundamental entity, substances or something like that, but there's sort of lots of them. Yeah. And maybe they also come in some different flavors. I'm not sure what, I don't recall.
I think you'd have to say that. Yeah. Different, you know, a dog is a different substance than a human. So that's really helpful. Just for all the substance dualists listening, that's the burden, that's the task. So to take that one up, that's really helpful, Jonathan. Thank you. Yeah. Philip, anything to say? I don't want to take your guys' time too much. This has been so fantastic, but maybe some final thoughts for us as we close out here.
I think this has been really useful. Yeah, I think we've really made progress on understanding our disagreement. And I think it seems to me with Jonathan and I, it's not necessarily so much a disagreement on the philosophy of mind, but in the background metaphysics, which worries me because this is more Jonathan's area than my own. But anyway, I seem to have views on it. The nature of the grounding relation, as I say, I tend to think of it more as this nothing over and above relation connected to truth making, at least when we're thinking of grounding in the physical world. It might be different in other arenas. And the connection to parsimony that brings in. So Yeah, so on my view, I'm very much looking for what is fundamental reality, and by that I mean what is the description of reality such that everything else is nothing over and above that fundamental story. That's what I'm looking for. That's how I think of physicalism. That's how I think of panpsychism. Whereas I think, although Jonathan is also puts his view in terms of grounding, he has a very different understanding of the grounding relation, and I think that's what leads to our differences. But I think that's been really helpful in helping me understand. I'm sorry if we've got a little bit into the weeds here, but it's helped me anyway understand the differences between our views. Yeah. I don't think we've persuaded each other, but never happens.
No, but you guys have successfully torn me apart in the middle, so I appreciate that one. Yeah, Jonathan, last closing thoughts.
Yeah, no, I just want to sort of agree with everything that Philip says right here, which is that, I mean, I think we do have kind of the same sort of quest to understand the most fundamental aspects of reality, but maybe a slightly different understanding of the sort of tools involved in doing so, where, you know, we have a disagreement, maybe not really about the mind so much, but like we were saying earlier, maybe we have disagreement about parties. And that showed how we were disagreeing about what it takes to make a party. And I think what this shows is that a lot of these disputes about the nature of the mind really can, in this case, do, I think, trace to some of the deepest underlying disputes about the right tools for metaphysical inquiry and the right methodology for metaphysical inquiry. And we're not going to settle those debates, but it's fascinating to see how they interconnect.
Yeah. So that's part of the reason I really enjoy both of your guys' work. I'm trying to be a philosopher of mind, but as I'm learning more and more, I realize how much the metaphysics I have to learn. And I'm really glad that you guys are wrestling with that stuff and helping the next folks like me get into it and think clearly about the mind and about reality. I just want to leave us with a really good quote from one of Jonathan's papers here. He says, "A properly choreographed system dances out a mind." I thought that was great since we're talking about parties and such.
Beautiful.
Well, thanks again, guys. This has been like a really a big honor for me, actually. I really admire and respect both you guys, and I appreciate your work, and especially your work in public philosophy, helping us get this stuff out there. So this has been like a real joy. I was trying not to smile the whole time because it was so much fun to be with both of you guys. Folks, that's going to have to do it for now. I'll drop links to both their websites. You can find more of their work, download their papers, and get going on the metaphysics of mind type stuff. But that's going to have to do it for now. This has been Parker's Pensies, and as always, all glory to God.